Here in the second hour of Issues Etc., we begin a conversation with Wendy Wright of Concerned Women for America in Washington, D.C. I was listening to this story on the radio this morning in the shower. That's not relevant. It was just, I barely heard the details, but I heard something about the morning after pill and the FDA and a political battle that ensues over Plan B, the so-called morning after pill. We'll get the details from Wendy Wright. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Suzanne Venker. She's author of the book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. There's a piece to play for you before that conversation. Some women who find, there's a woman in Great Britain who has written a big piece in one of their papers saying that she finds her children boring. And she hires the nanny to read bedtime stories and things like that. And then they do a couple interviews with ladies at the park with their kids on their play dates. And the mothers are all saying, yes, motherhood is boring. It's tedious. It's not intellectually stimulating. We'll see what Suzanne Venker has to say. In the third hour of the program, we'll talk about the so-called secret rapture. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado, will be our guest. Before we talk with Wendy Wright of Concerned Women for America about this FDA decision, half decision, to ease access to Plan B, the morning after pill, let's hear more from CNN.
The drug is called Plan B, and it's already available with a prescription. But for about 3 years, the company has been trying to get permission from the FDA to sell it over the counter without a prescription. Plan B contains a high dose of the ingredient currently in traditional birth control pills. And when used within 72 hours of unprotected sex, it can lower the risk of pregnancy by almost 90%. But advocates say it's often difficult for women to get a prescription filled so quickly.
Timing is very key here, and this will make it much more accessible. Accessibility is a key issue.
The drug works by stopping ovulation, or if the egg has been fertilized, it increases the chance it won't attach to the uterus. Critics charge that is abortion. The American Life League says, quote, Plan B, commonly known as emergency contraception, is a deadly cocktail of drugs that even according to its manufacturers can act to take the life of newly conceived babies in the days immediately following fertilization, close quote. But advocates disagree, saying if a woman is already pregnant, the pills have no effect. The government had already agreed that it was safe to be sold over the counter to adults, but kept delaying a decision because of concerns that teens might have access to the medicine. If approved, Plan B would be sold behind the counter, much like cigarettes, but by a pharmacist who can check the age of a woman before it's sold. Before this happens, the FDA and the pills manufacturer must meet to hash out some of the fine points. Christy Feig, CNN, Washington.
Well, there's a story from CNN. You may have read about this also in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch. FDA willing to ease access to the morning after pill. Wendy Wright, president of Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C., is our guest to talk about this story. Wendy, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
And congratulations on your new position there at Concerned Women for America.
Thank you.
How long have you been with them?
I've been with CWA for about 7 years and became president just in February.
Really? Well, then congratulations again.
Thank you.
Okay, give us the ins and outs of this story, beginning with what the morning after pill or Plan B really is.
Well, it's a high dose of the birth control pill, and the birth control pill requires a prescription because if women have medical conditions like diabetes or heart problem or liver problem, they will not be given a prescription for a low dose of the drug. It's too dangerous for them. Blood clot, heart attack, stroke are some of the serious complications that even women who get a prescription can end up having. And what the FDA is considering doing is unprecedented. Never has the FDA approved that a high dose of a drug be available without a prescription when a low dose of that same drug requires a prescription. Well, the FDA originally declined the over-the-counter status because of concern that the drug had not been adequately tested on adolescents. What would happen to a 13-year-old that takes this drug or takes it multiple times, which is more likely that adolescents are going to rely on it because it would be kind of a secret way for them to cover up their sexual activity. And in the case of statutory rape, in which you've got an adult man who's sexually abusing a minor girl, that rapist could go into a drugstore, buy the drug, no questions asked, and turn around and give it to a 13-year-old. That is one of our major concerns with what the FDA is doing right now. The FDA announced yesterday it's negotiating with the owner of the drug, Bar Labs, to come up with a scheme where the drug would be available to any woman over 18 without a prescription. Anyone under 18 would need a prescription. Well, it's a bit ludicrous to think that there could be a gender restriction on who buys a drug. Planned Parenthood would challenge that in 5 minutes. They would send a husband in saying he wants to get it for his wife, and they would immediately drop that gender restriction. But on top of that, the man could then, right in the store, turn around and give it to a 13-year-old without the 13-year-old's parents' knowledge. So this is a recipe for disaster.
Okay, so if, given what you say about the high-dose, low-dose inconsistency, it is unthinkable for the FDA to think about doing something like this, as you said, requiring a low dose of the drug to be prescribed by a doctor while allowing a high dose of the drug to be sold over-the-counter without a prescription. What's really driving the FDA at this point, or what's really driving the political forces around the FDA when it comes to the morning after pill?
Yeah, let's start with the political forces. The abortion advocates have made this a number one priority. I believe they're doing it because when the topic is abortion, they lose, whether it's legislation, elections, or public opinion. So instead, they're focusing on what they like to call emergency contraception, that it would only be used in emergencies. But they then define emergency to be any time that a woman has engaged in unprotected sex. Well, that could have happened multiple times in a month. Now, the argument is that if the drug were easily available, there would be fewer pregnancies and then fewer abortions. But the real-world experience is that when the morning-after pill is available without a prescription, teenage pregnancies do not go down. In fact, pregnancies overall do not go down. Abortions do not go down. In fact, they go up. But sexually transmitted diseases skyrocket. So, for example, in Sweden, the teen pregnancy went up, or teen abortions went up about 39%. In England, the STD rates across the board, chlamydia, syphilis, gonorrhea, all went up. In Scotland, Scotland made the morning after pill available without a prescription in 1999. In 2005, Scotland reported the highest number of abortions since the country decriminalized abortion in 1967. So I think one reason why the abortion advocates are demanding that this drug be easily available is it would result in more clients for groups like Planned Parenthood, more customers coming in who end up pregnant because they relied on this drug and it's not nearly as effective as other kinds of birth control, and then they're more susceptible to having an abortion because they were never intending to get pregnant, but then the Planned Parenthood would end up with more clients to be tested and treated for sexually transmitted diseases. So Planned Parenthood and other family planning clinics win all the way around. They can sell more of the drug and end up with more clients.
All right. Then let's turn to the FDA itself. And another individual finds him kind of himself unwittingly, perhaps, at the center of this maelstrom, and that is acting FDA commissioner Andrew Eschenbach. He is acting FDA commissioner. The FDA has been without a full-time commissioner for, what, 8 years, something along those lines, maybe even more. But there are forces in the Senate in particular that are calling for a hold on his full nomination until Plan B is offered over-the-counter by the FDA.
Yeah, and those senators are Hillary Clinton and Patty Murray. Both are ardent abortion advocates. And again, they want to put the focus on what they call contraceptive and get it off of abortion. They argue that if there were easier access to this drug, there'd be fewer abortions, and can't we all agree on that? But the real-world experience is the abortion numbers don't go down, and the evidence is that they actually go up. So, as you mentioned, Andrew von Eschenbach, he had his hearing today in the Senate to become FDA commissioner. These senators have put a hold, but what I find very disconcerting is that some kind of deal is being made that this drug could be approved non-prescription, go over the counter, in exchange for Andrew von Eschenbach winning the votes of the senators. So that would be a permanent policy decision that will live on well past this administration in exchange for a 2-year political appointment. I don't think that women and girls' health should be put at risk just for someone's career.
Do you see that, do you see that the current White House, the administration, Bush administration, understands the trade-off that they would have to make to compromise here just to get von Eschenbach in for those 2 years?
Well, I've been, let's just say I've been communicating rather strongly with the administration and the FDA, to making sure that they know that this would end up being very harmful to women and girls, and that people who believe strongly in the sanctity of life and who care about women's health would be absolutely dismayed if this a drug was made easily available. The one thing I'm kind of hanging my hat on is that the FDA, in their announcement, said that the owner of the drug, Bar Labs, would have to come up with a rigorous plan to ensure that the drug would only be sold to women over 18. Well, as I mentioned, the person who buys the drug may not be the person who takes the drug, but on top of that, I don't think that there is any way that Bar Labs could enforce or would have the incentive to enforce. First of all, Bar Labs, all they're looking at is their bottom line. They want to sell more drugs, so they're not going to want to limit the sales. But on top of that, Bar doesn't have the ability to catch someone, to arrest someone, to fine them, or to jail them. Now, the argument may be, well, Bar would choose to not sell their drug to that drugstore anymore. But, I mean, let's be real. Bar Labs is in the business of making money. They're not going to want to find anyone who's violating. And if they did, well, I'm sure they'd find a way of just kind of ignoring it.
Is Bar Pharmaceutical, as far as anyone can tell, applying any pressure in this case?
Well, I think they have, but more importantly has been the political pressure from the abortion lobby. I think Barr has been able to almost sit back and allow the abortion lobby to go to town on this. One of the abortion groups, Center for Reproductive Rights, which is such a radical group that it sued the state of Louisiana over a law requiring safety regulations be enforced in abortion clinics, making sure that abortion clinics follow the same safety guidelines as any other outpatient operating clinic. That's how radical this group is. So this group sued the FDA for not approving this drug as over-the-counter. So Bar Labs hasn't had to pay for any attorneys. The abortion groups are doing it for them.
Let's talk about the timing issue when it comes to this drug itself. Neither you nor I are medical experts, but at least according to what I've gleaned from guests here and also from the news reports, timing when it comes to Plan B is pretty critical as to what it actually does in a woman's body. It can be a contraceptive if taken immediately after unprotected sex. It could also be an abortifacient if taken later.
Well, the drug owner and the promoters all say that it works in three ways: by delaying ovulation, preventing fertilization, the third way of inhibiting implantation of an embryo, that's a new life. That's the mode of operation that that is of great concern. And it would just seem to stand to reason that if a woman is taking the drug after sexual intercourse, then it would be too late to delay ovulation and maybe too late regarding fertilization. So the mode of operation the drug may be relying on most would be that third way. Now, it's difficult to know because you can't really set up any trials to figure out how it is operating. But I'm just going off of what the drug owner says and what Planned Parenthood says. And at the least, women should be given full information so they can make up their minds if they want to take a drug that could end a new life. Instead, it's kind of glossed over. They just say, oh, it might inhibit implantation. Well, they don't finish the sentence. Implantation of what? That would be a human embryo. That's a new life.
We're talking with Wendy Wright, president of Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. In about 15 minutes, an interview with Suzanne Venker, author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers. We're going to respond to a recent article in a London newspaper about the boredom of motherhood with Suzanne, coming up in about 15 minutes. Well, some might say, Wendy, that social conservatives are hypocritical on this issue because most of them would support the low-dose birth control pill, and yet they many of them are opposed to the high-dose so-called morning-after pill. How would you respond to that?
Well, we have not opposed whether the drug is available with prescription. The great concern is what happens when it's available without a prescription. The evidence is in. We don't have to experiment on American women. We can look to what's happened in other countries. The pregnancy rate does not decrease. The abortion rate does not decrease. It appears that it increases. And the sexually transmitted disease rate increases. I think that's because women, according to surveys done of women and pharmacists in these other countries, women admitted that they were more likely to consciously choose to engage in sexual activity without any other form of birth control because they knew they could go down to a drugstore in the morning to get this drug. And so that also puts them at higher risk of getting a sexually transmitted disease. The morning after pill does absolutely nothing to prevent or treat sexually transmitted diseases. Now, the owner of the drug, the original owner, ran ads in college newspapers for the drug. The ads had pictures of a bunch of college men, a fraternity that said, so many men, so many reasons to have backup contraception. In other words, encouraging multiple sex partners. Well, that's what puts women at greatest risk of getting an STD, is having multiple sex partners.
Let's talk about the prescription issue then, too, and that has to do with whether or not, if the FDA were to approve, ultimately, Plan B over-the-counter without a doctor's prescription, wouldn't they, to be consistent, coming back to your first point, have to then say, well, then why are we making the birth control pill a prescription drug?
That is a great concern. That this could be a push for the goal of taking the prescription status off of birth control pills. Now, all the tests that have been done, both on birth control pills and morning after pill tests and experience in the U.S., has pre-screened women. That means that women who have numerous kinds of medical conditions, like diabetes, about half the women in the U.S. who have diabetes don't know that they have it. So if they are not being seen by a doctor before taking the drug, this could end up truly harming them. So there is a great concern that if the high dose of the drug is available without a prescription, that means to the general population, everyone, any woman, regardless of what medical conditions she have, could end up taking the drug, then they may push for the birth control pill to have no medical oversight, and that is not in the best interest of women's health.
A doctor's role in this is sometimes overlooked here, and it seems to me that if a woman has a doctor she can trust, if a woman has a doctor she presumably chooses their own physician, more or less, why would this be an issue for it simply to be a prescription drug?
Well, it really shouldn't be an issue, and that's why it should say prescription. The proponents are arguing that women might not be able to have access to their doctor quick enough to take it. But really what they're saying is we should put multitudes of women's health at risk just to accommodate a woman who has had a risky sexual experience on a weekend. And besides that, family planning clinics could easily open their doors to accommodate women. But instead, I think that they're using this as a way to push for easy access to the morning after pill by not being as available to the women as the women would want. Then they can end up with more clients for their STD services, their pregnancy testing, and their abortion services.
We've had a spate here locally about 6 months ago of local pharmacists running afoul of big chain drugstores who refuse to fill prescriptions for the morning after pill.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering about the local pharmacist. He's got his own shop. He buys drugs like anyone else from the drug manufacturers, and he refuses to, or is working for a Walgreens or something like that, he refuses to sell an over-the-counter version of Plan B, if that's the decision the FDA makes. Sounds like it's really going to complicate things legally for everyone involved.
Yeah, sadly it will. And there have been these little sting operations by Planned Parenthood. In fact, Planned Parenthood of Texas just put out an e-alert to their members, telling the members to go and try and trap pharmacists, to go into pharmacies and ask for the morning after pill and try and find someone who won't give it to them so that they can then try and get that pharmacist fired. these poor pharmacists have been caught in the middle of this abortion campaign. And there are some rural pharmacies that don't even stock it because, frankly, there's no demand for it. There, in fact, many pharmacists, not even just in rural areas, have reported that they don't keep it on hand because there's just no demand. Customers are not asking for it. So these pharmacists are put in a difficult position that they would have to keep it in stock just in case a Planned Parenthood spy comes in and tries to trap them. But there are pharmacists who don't want to supply it because they feel it would violate their beliefs, their religious beliefs, their conscience, that it could, the drug could end up causing an abortion, and they don't feel that they should have any part in causing an abortion. Now, there are protections for doctors and nurses that they are not forced to commit or participate in a surgical abortion, and yet these pharmacists are being required by the drugstore chains because of pressure by Planned Parenthood and the abortion lobby to what in their minds is to assist in a chemical causing abortion. So we can kind of see where this is headed. If this, if Planned Parenthood is successful in this, it will be used to try and force doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers to commit abortions themselves.
One quick final question with less than a minute here. Clear up any confusion that the listener may still have between Plan B, the morning after pill, and its more sinister cousin, not pharmaceutically, but at least in my mind, RU486, the abortion pill.
Oh, yes. Many people get them confused. RU46 is taken after the embryo has implanted in the woman's womb. So it would be taken supposedly only up to 7 weeks after the pregnancy has started, the baby has started, although abortion clinics are going beyond that, which puts women at even higher risk of deadly complications. The morning after pill is the high dose of the birth control pill, so the idea is it would be taken before the embryo has implanted in the woman's womb.
Wendy Wright is president of Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. Their website, I suggest you visit it, cwfa.org, cwfa.org. Wendy, thank you very much for being our guest. And again, congratulations on your new position.
Thank you very much.
One of the things that LCMS World Relief is doing, not only underwriting, generously underwriting issues, et cetera, but also defending life from beginning to end. Whenever we talk about these issues, they're all of one cloth, whether we are defending the lives of people who are threatened by natural disasters, seeking to sustain their lives, or whether we are defending the life of the unborn, or whether we're defending the life of people at the end, we would say at the end of their lives, or the disabled, LCMS World Relief sees it as all one act of mercy incumbent upon them, and your relief support is vital to them. You can earmark a donation to LCMS World Relief for any of their efforts worldwide or locally by calling them toll-free, 1-888-930-4438. That number again, 1-888-930-4438. Or you can find out more about LCMS World Relief and what they're doing, Christ-centered, cross-focused relief efforts, at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. When we come back from this break, you probably will believe what you're going to hear. Women who are bored with motherhood, and Suzanne Venker will be our guest. A London newspaper has a piece in there from a mother who says her children simply bore her. Suzanne Venker is author of the book called Seven Myths of Working Mothers. She'll be our guest right after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
When we confess in the Apostles' Creed that Jesus descended into hell, we don't mean that he went there to suffer for our sins. We mean that he went there to be exalted before his enemies. But he did suffer for our sins the pains of hell. It comes in the end of Mark chapter 15 when he cries out, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" Let's talk about it with Pastor Tim Ostermeyer next time on The Bible Study, weekday mornings, 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Life sometimes seems like a wild ride down a raging, churning river. Find aid, refreshment, and direction for the journey with psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson on Focus on the Family. With team effort, you can navigate the rapids of circumstance.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. American prisons hold a dark secret: sex crimes against inmates. The brutality behind bars has gone largely unreported until now. A federal study tracked prison rapes and other sexual misconduct and found more than 6,200 violations in our nation's prisons and jails during 2005. Josh Montes has reaction.
Alan Beck authored the study for the Bureau of Justice Statistics.
The survey itself is very revealing. It told us things we had not known before in terms of the amount of physical violence. About half of the inmate-on-inmate incidents involved physical force.
The federal survey adds weight to the independent research of Cindy Struckman Johnson with the National Prison Rape Elimination Commission.
I have information from over 2,000 male prisoners and information from about 500 male victims. And of those male victims, only one-fourth reported their incident to anybody working at the prison.
And not even the victim's shame of being violated can convince them to speak out.
The number one reason is fear of retaliation. Perpetrators easily intimidate prisoners. There's no way to escape.
Pat Nolan with Prison Fellowship says the report is a good start for the faith community to come to grips with what can accurately be called a national disgrace.
Hopefully Christians would say this is intolerable and we will not tolerate a system that allows this to go on in it. And so these figures help establish that this is not a minimal problem.
Saddest of all, 38% of the sexual misconduct involved prison officials with inmates. For Family News in Focus, I'm Josh Montes.
The report is the second required by federal law. It showed that Texas, Florida, California, and Ohio had the highest rates of reported sex crimes. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO, join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with T. Jason Smith, a human resources expert, about the employment picture for college graduates. He's the author of Leaving Campus and Going to Work. We'll meet Jerry Haskew of the Cumberland Trio, a group reunited for a reunion CD, and we'll hear about their history and experiences on the next Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
You can delve into the mind of 16th century reformer Martin Luther with our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, titled Luther's World of Thought. How did Luther's mentors and teachers influence him? How did the European class system and political climate help and hinder his reforming efforts? Find out with Luther's World of Thought. For more information, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Luther's World of Thought, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Suzanne Venker hasn't been with us for a while, but we thought about her when we heard this story. We're going to play it for you in just a minute from the CBS Early Show. Apparently, women both on this side and that side of the pond find motherhood tedious and not intellectually stimulating. And you know what I thought when I heard it? What I thought was, what about fatherhood? I mean, if motherhood is boring, isn't fatherhood boring? What does that mean? What does it say? Are we willing to admit that there are some hardships to being parents in this world? Suzanne Venker will join us here in just a moment. But first here, I'll let you hear what we heard earlier today from the CBS Early Program on motherhood.
In an article in London's Daily Mail, writer Helen Kirwan Taylor declared, "My children bore me." She said she hates going to children's birthday parties, watching her kids compete in sports, and she even pays the nanny to read the bedtime stories. Though the comments have caused a controversy, some mothers are saying they can relate.
Yeah, I would rather go shopping than going to a birthday party. I'm not even gonna lie.
Kutisha Lee believes there are plenty of women who find motherhood tedious at times, but won't admit it.
They probably are ashamed to say it because someone else will say, oh, you can't say that. How dare you? My God, she's precious. She's a joy.
Changing diapers is not exciting. My daughter is only 8 weeks old, so she can't do that much yet, so it's not always exciting.
It's not as stimulating intellectually as being around adults, but you just have to find a balance.
Of course, all the women I spoke to said the sacrifices are worth it.
No, it is tedious. I mean, it's not the easiest thing in the world. But I think when you look at the child and you see them, you know, just growing and changing all the time, and that's the rewarding part about it.
For The Early Show, Debbie Turner, CBS News, New York.
All right. It all sparked by a London newspaper article about the boredom of motherhood. Suzanne Venker, a former middle school English teacher and mother of two here in St. Louis, author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers, joins us for her response. Suzanne, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
All right. Your general response as a mother and as someone who has really looked in depth at working mothers and the contrast of working outside and inside the home. What's your response?
I'm thrilled, actually, that this woman wrote this because I think it's very important and very telling. There's actually a part in my book, Seven Myths, where I discuss this very thing, where I acknowledge the tedious, the mundane, and the monotonous side of raising children. I think it's important to acknowledge that that piece exists because right now I think we're stuck in this mold where people think that women today or mothers fall into one of two groups. They're either the type that just love to be around children all the time. That would be the stay-at-home mom group. And then there's the group that just doesn't like to be around children all the time, and that's the working mother group. And I argue that, in fact, these two groups are not even real, that most women are some variation thereof, and that what really distinguishes those who are at home full-time or work only part-time from those who have chosen to work full-time and use nannies and daycare to raise their kids, what separates them is the former group's willingness to do this work anyway, despite the fact that there is this piece to it that is not the most exciting thing in the world. And, of course, if you look at any job that we do, whether we're whether it's in the marketplace or yard work, there's going to be bad sides or these, you know, not so fun sides of the job, but that doesn't mean you check out of it. So I think this person, this Helen Kerwin Taylor's article, is actually very insightful. It's very it's very telling about where we are today with the idea that if something just doesn't excite you, you can just check out. I mean, you wouldn't find this article would not have existed 30 years ago, not just because people wouldn't dare say that it's not always exciting to raise kids, but also because there was a collective understanding that it's the right thing to do, despite that fact. And today, that just doesn't exist anymore.
When I heard it, of course, I approached it as a father, and I thought to myself, well, I spend the majority of the work week away from home or sleeping. Okay, that's right. The majority of my hours, and then the time spent with the kids during the school year can be quite tedious and quite trying.
Mm-hmm.
We've got homework. We've got cleaning up and putting things away, bedtime. In the morning, it's a very routine life of making breakfast and all. And I pitch in those things. I'm very much a modern man, I guess you would say. But I was thinking myself, you know, if the measure of whether or not this was worth doing was whether I was intellectually stimulated or found it fulfilling personally, I'd stay at work all week long.
Well, that's a really interesting point because I think of my husband with respect to this as well, or any father. If there's anybody who could complain about the tedious nature of it, it's really the fathers because, as you say, basically everything that they do with respect to parenting is the tedious side because they don't get the good stuff that we get because we're around all the time. So you could really complain more than the women can.
Yeah, well, and that's true, especially during the school year.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what greatness do you see Monday through Friday? Well, you have some off hours there, but you know, for those who are at home on nights and weekends, that's when they get their glimpse into the rewards, I guess I would say, of those sacrifices that they make. Mothers are much more likely, at least at home mothers, much more likely to experience those rewards And men aren't, or fathers aren't. So they really could complain if anybody was going to. But then this Helen Kerwin Taylor is like the stereotypical father, because she is living the same life.
So is one of the myths of motherhood, not just working motherhood, but motherhood, that it ought to be, this...
That you should enjoy it all the time.
Yeah, enjoy it all the time, yeah. Punctuated by mountaintop experiences of joy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's one of the myths that... that probably I would agree with some of the responses that CBS Early News got from some of those mothers. I do think that people think it's taboo to say. I would say that that's true. I experienced that. I'm probably one of the few people who is, pretty upfront about the downsides or the not so much the downsides, just the difficulties and the challenges that go with the job. But again, when all is said and done, what are you left with? The Helen Kerwin Taylors of the world are saying, you know, they're going to pay someone else to do it because it's just beneath her, and she can't bring herself to care about the things that her kids care about. And the other side of that is this just comes with it's part of the territory. It just comes with it. And the idea that you don't have to do anything that makes you uncomfortable or bored or that's difficult is kind of an example of really a greater problem that we have in society today, which is that idea that if it, doesn't feel good, you shouldn't have to do it. You just have to be happy all the time and be doing things that are there for you. And that's kind of the point of my book, as you know, The Seven Myths, which is what it is that we're doing this motherhood thing for, which is for the kids, not for us.
We're talking with Suzanne Venker. She's a former middle school English teacher and a mother of two here in St. Louis. She's author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. DB is waiting patiently in Florissant. Hi, DB.
Hello. Hey, I want to first thank you and for having this guest on. Occasionally I've heard her before, and I just think she's fantastic. It's just really encouraged me. My wife and I have been working towards adoption for the last couple of years because we're unable to have biological children. And so right now we're working towards adopting a baby, and we're having a lot of problems with some of the legal issues working out with the birth parents. And so right now we don't know whether we'll be able to adopt this child or not. And it frustrates me when I hear articles and people say these kinds of things, because they don't realize the gift they've been given. And, you know, much of life is tedious.
Most of it, you're right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You should say most of it. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, the greatest joy comes out of when you push through those things, mm-hmm. and you work through them as someone who's responsible to God and recognizes that God has given us labor, and that part of that labor is going to be boredom and struggle, mm-hmm. Even with something as wonderful as children. But I think that people who say these kinds of things and write these kinds of things don't recognize the blessing they've been given in children, because even though taking care of children might be tedious, they're human beings, and they're deserving of love and respect, and their feelings and their interests and what gives them joy and what takes care of their needs should be valued. And so,
all right, DB, thank you very much. Thanks for the call. Your reaction, Suzanne?
Well, he's hit the nail on the head. There's no question about it. The biggest piece of what he said there was what has happened to motherhood over the last 30 years is that it's been turned on its head, and it's become an issue of what mothers want rather than what children need. And this article by this woman is just an example of that. And the fact, as I said, that she's able to write it and print it is something that, as I say, wouldn't have happened years ago, because it's more acceptable now to say, yeah, this is for the birds. I don't want to do it. I'm going to check out and pay someone else to do this for me. And it's this collective idea that that motherhood is about what you want as a woman, which is why, by the way, you hear very little chastising on either side when people say, when you hear the debate about working mothers and people say, can we just support one another? Whatever you choose to do is what you choose to do, and that's great, and that should be honored and respected. But, well, no, it shouldn't, because there's a huge chasm there between the groups that are choosing to push forth despite the tedious nature of it and do it anyway because it's the right thing to do, and the people who are checking out, like this woman.
This is Jan, and she writes us via our email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, from Pennsylvania. She says, I'm writing this in between making dinner, which I do daily, and folding the laundry, which I do three times a week. It sure gets tedious. So would working for IBM. Life runs in cycles. Routines make our life predictable and stable. My kids sort of depend on my daily cooking, baking, cleaning, caring, laundry. Thank God for tedium, she writes. And on to one more dinner preparation and throwing another load of laundry in, says Jan. Your response to her.
Yet another great example. I thought about that when I read the woman's article, because where is it ever written that life is supposed to be about being happy and having fun all the time? I mean, it's like the caller said. Life is really, when you think about it, it is kind of boring, no matter what you're doing. It's so, I mean, boring in the sense that it's routine. I mean, every time you wake up in the morning, don't we all have this, again, that collective idea of, oh, here's another day, I'm going to go do the same thing, and, you know, but you don't say, woe is me, isn't this awful? You just keep plugging away, and hopefully you know in your head that this is all worth something much deeper, and you don't focus on that tedious nature.
Kathy's calling from St. Charles. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I know you, your guest had mentioned that she felt like parenting is supposed to be done for the kids, but I think a lot of parents have had children and want to have children because of the dream of what they want in a child and watching their children grow and mature. And so it is about the kids, but it's also about dreams and hopes and things that we want in society because we have kids. We want to have grandkids. We want to see our kids get married. We want to see them go to college. So it is about the kids, but it's also about hopes and dreams. And I guess the reason I'm more aware of this than maybe some other parents is because I have a child with special needs, and some of those hopes and dreams changed. Mm-hmm. And then they changed again when he had another diagnosis, when there's just, you know, it's a little more tedious and a little more mundane when you are still changing diapers when your child is 9, and that doesn't seem to be an end in sight. But you know that the Lord will give you the strength to see you through it.
All right, Kathy, thank you so much for that call. Suzanne?
I think that's a very unique situation, and I certainly feel for her, and I can certainly understand that her life must seem far more tedious than the average person's who don't have children with special needs. But she's right. It is about the parents, and that's to some degree, and that is certainly not a bad thing. I don't mean to suggest that at all. It's just that when push comes to shove, this transformation that has occurred over the last several decades of focusing on motherhood as being about women and their women's rights is a mistake.
And I would say to Kathy that she has been given in relationship to the rest of us, a unique calling there as a mother and as a parent, because this child's childhood, in the sense of the responsibility she's going to have to exercise for her child, mm-hmm. isn't just going to last a few years like it does for most of us.
Right.
It's going to last a lifetime.
Right.
That is an entirely unique situation, mm-hmm. calling for, I think, probably also unique strengths mm-hmm. in a mother. Let's talk with Anne in Crestwood. Hi, Anne.
Oh, good afternoon. This has really gotten my ire up. That just sounds like the most outrageously selfish woman. I would question whether she's depressed or not, and I would feel horrible for her children. It just seems so outrageous, but I'm coming from being the oldest of 10 children and how much fun it was to be with other kids. I'm not a grandmother yet. I have 2 children, but I watch the 2 little boys behind me that are 2 and 4, and children, I think, are the most beautiful thing, some of the most beautiful things the world has. I just find this outrageously selfish.
And you're talking about the London Daily article.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I can't even. It's typical of today's world to even go there. It's beyond me.
Anne, thank you very much. You know, I was thinking about that, picking up on her call, Suzanne. It has to do, perhaps in my mind, with maturity. You know, I tell my kids all the time, life is 99% doing what you'd rather not be doing. And then there's the 1% of things that you do, and you realize, actually, the real fulfillment in life comes from sometimes the mundane and the banal. But what are we teaching our kids when, say, in the case of a woman who says, I'm just going to pay the nanny to read the bedtime stories, what are we teaching our kids parenthood and family life is about?
Oh, no question about it. I thought about the woman's children as well, and that she's just going to reap what she sows. I think there are a lot of, I think there are a lot of grown children now who unfortunately came from parents who have that attitude, particularly the ones who have chosen to return to work full time and put their kids in daycare or get nannies, and we're seeing the results of a generation of kids who are not capable of putting other people at the center, and that their needs and their desires are really going to always be of paramount importance because they didn't get their needs met as children, and they don't have a frame of reference for how you sacrifice or give. And, of course, once again, that goes back to kind of defeating the whole reason that we're kind of here on this earth, isn't it? You know, it's just so, it's so sad.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here's Robin calling from her car. Hi, Robin.
Yes, Pastor. I've often felt that most of our children, or quite a few of them maybe, have been born as a result of a favorite pastime of our society, which is quite a shame. And I think they become more of a burden or an inconvenience for some parents, as they weren't really prepared to bring this person into this world and have to nurture them and take care of them and see to their needs.
Thank you very much, Robin. I guess she goes to the issue of becoming parents in the first place and having a well-rounded and a realistic picture of what motherhood is really going to be about. Give us that well-rounded, realistic picture insofar as you can here, Susan.
One of the first things I wanted to get across in Seven Myths was the idea that just because motherhood isn't always delightful and wonderful, although it certainly is that, but because it's not always that way, doesn't mean that we should check out of it. So in my point of, in my defense of that, I lay out what those difficulties are. Like, for example, the tedious nature of raising children. And there is a chapter in the book where I get into the specifics of, for example, colic, which I experienced with one of my children. And how difficult that was to go through, and how it's okay to talk about what it's like to deal with babies crying, and how that rocks your world and your marriage for a number of months, depending on what you're, you know, how long you deal with it. That's just one example of what you may face, and then of course how it's going to affect your past career life and your work life, and how it affects your relationship with your spouse, and all of these things are things that I don't think people do consider today. And I do worry that one of your callers who commented on how this woman didn't think ahead and didn't really want to nurture her children, I do think that that happens, and I see it myself in so many people who want children. Just really, you want to ask them why they did want them, because I'm assuming that it's really just to kind of complete the picture, that it just wouldn't feel right or normal if you didn't have children. So they go ahead and have them, thinking that's what you're supposed to do. But in reality, they really don't want anything to do with the hands-on work that's involved. So in the book, I lay that out and suggest that if you don't want to do that work, then you just shouldn't have them.
Then finally, if we are in an age where, as you said before, a mother can write a piece in a London paper that says, "My children bore me."
Mm-hmm.
And yet her solution is not, and you know what, that's part of being a mom.
Right.
Her solution is, I'm going to pay someone else to do the job that I signed on for with these kids because I can.
Mm-hmm.
Living in that age, someone who says, look, my fulfillment, it can't be my fulfillment. If I find it so tedious, what would you say to them? I mean, if I find motherhood this tedious, I am not being fulfilled.
You mean after they've had them?
Oh, yeah, definitely after they've had them.
Because I know what I'd say before they had them, if they thought that that's what it was. But afterwards, probably some tough love there, you know, and probably I would say, I'm sorry. You know, it absolutely is a shock to the system, and it is different from life as you know it. But you have to do it anyway, and here are the ways you can cope. And I think that way of tackling it, rather than saying, just we should all understand one another's choice to not be at home with children if you don't want to, because some people just aren't cut out for that, is the mistake that we make, because that's not the answer to the problem that it is difficult or tedious. The answer to the problem that it's tedious and difficult is, as I say, here are your steps or your coping methods for how you can go about making it better for you while you're there, not, okay, it's okay, I understand, you can go back to work because you can't hack it, kind of a thing.
Is this, very very briefly, is this kind of our present age wants motherhood without the inconvenience of the children?
Oh, absolutely. We're living in that age. There's no question about it. In fact, I have some quotes in the book where people actually come out and say that.
Finally, then, do I remember correctly, are you writing a sequel to Seven Myths of Working Mothers on the subject of fatherhood?
It's funny you should mention that. It's a little bit more off. It's not specifically just about parenthood, but I am working on something that has more to do with what has happened with men and fatherhood in today's world. Yeah. So I'll let you know about that.
All right. Yes, please do, because we'll want to talk to you when it's ready to hit the presses. Folks, you can read an excerpt of Seven Myths of Working Mothers at the following website, www.spencepublishing.com, www.spencepublishing.com, or you can purchase Seven Myths of Working Mothers by calling Spence Publishing, their toll-free number, 1-888-SPENPUB. It's 1-888-SPENPUB. The book is currently half price, 1-888-SPENPUB. Suzanne Venker is a former middle school English teacher and mother of two here in St. Louis, and she's author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Suzanne, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, when we come back after this break, a subject that is on the mind of many a Christian nowadays. Not on mine so much, because I'm not expecting it to happen. I am expecting Jesus to come back. Don't worry about that. But I'm not expecting a secret rapture. But many Christians are, and they're watching the news, and they're seeing things heating up in the Middle East and around the state of Israel and with Israel's enemies. Some are saying Armageddon is coming. Well, according to their end times timetable, Armageddon is preceded by what they would believe is a secret rapture of the church. We're going to find out what it is, whether or not Scripture teaches any such thing as a secret rapture of the church. Most people are familiar with this by reading or at least knowing about the general plot line of the Left Behind series. Well, there wouldn't be a Left Behind series if there wasn't this odd teaching of a secret rapture of the church. The two kind of go together. We'll find out whether or not the backbone of the Left Behind series and this teaching of the secret rapture is scripturally warranted after this break. Our guest when we come back for an hour-long conversation on the rapture, Pastor Brian Wolfmiller. He's pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado, and he made a presentation at last month's Higher Things Youth Conference. I hear it went over very well, and that no one disappeared suddenly in the middle of it, called In Case of Rapture, Can I Have Your Car? Great title. We'll talk more about the rapture on the other side of this break. Brian Wolfmiller is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.